Today we're diving into a headline you've probably seen everywhere. Amazon's plan to replace more than 500,000 jobs with robots. But if all we do is count the jobs, we're missing the deeper story. This isn't just an employment shift, it's a cultural one. Automation has become the scaffolding that's rebuilding how work is organized and understood. It's redesigning the office itself, not only as a physical space, but as a system that shapes how people behave, communicate, and even define purpose.
Exactly. And if you look closely, the jobs themselves aren't disappearing so much as changing form. It's less about people being replaced and more about how they're absorbed into new hybrid systems. Many workers have become the invisible connective tissue of automation, monitoring, maintaining, and patching over what the technology can't yet do. The human presence hasn't vanished, but it's often hidden, ghost-like, haunting the edges of these new work environments.
Headlines thrive on shock value, 500,000 jobs gone, but the real story is quieter and much deeper. What's changing is how architecture, algorithms, and behavioral data are starting to merge into one continuous system. It's the same impulse we've seen for more than a century. Think of Frederick Taylor with his stopwatch, the open plan office that followed, and now the dashboards that track every click and movement. Each era tries to make the invisible aspects of work visible. But visibility always comes with a price, doesn't it?
It does. You can see it in those Amazon warehouses that run on predictive scheduling, or on corporate campuses where every movement is logged and analyzed. Space and data have merged. If you're not on the radar, you almost don't exist. And now that automation handles so much of the routine, the real question is what meaning people will find in being there at all. What rituals, what purpose will make presence feel necessary again?
Right. Automation isn't just about replacing tasks. It's behavioral design at scale. That's really where today's story begins. The way technology is starting to script not only what we do, but how we do it.
So take those return to office mandates at places like JP Morgan. They're framed as a way to show commitment, to prove you're really there. But now software like HumanEyes or Cisco Spaces can measure exactly that. Every check-in, every movement, even patterns of conversation. It's the rise of the quantified workspace where everything becomes data. And I wonder, does all that visibility actually build trust? Or does it just make people feel more exposed?
That's really where the tension lies, isn't it? There's this belief, maybe even an illusion, that more data means more fairness. If everyone's measured, it must be objective. But I think what we call transparency is starting to feel a lot more like exposure. The office has turned into a kind of stage where you're performing for an algorithm instead of a manager. And it connects back to something we've talked about before, the difference between quiet quitting and what we called quiet cracking. One is people quietly drifting away. The other is staying put, going through the motions, but feeling watched and disconnected.
Yeah, and I think we're starting to see how data about performance becomes the performance itself. There's this feedback loop: be visible, be present, get rewarded. But what happens to the people who don't fit that pattern? The caregivers, the neurodivergent, the introverts who aren't built for constant visibility? They risk being overlooked, not because of their work, but because they don't match the metric.
What's really striking is how this logic starts to feel a lot like predictive policing, the Minority Report scenario. You're not only judged on what you do, but on what the system expects you to do next. The more it quantifies, the less room there is for trust, for adaptation, or for that bit of healthy mystery that makes human work, well, human.
It's true, these tools can reveal bias, but they can also deepen anxiety. Sometimes it feels like surveillance with extra steps. What's sold as transparency often turns into exposure. And for people who aren't wired for self-promotion, it's just exhausting. One place where this really stands out is when you compare Amazon's robotics facility in Shreveport with somewhere like Salesforce Tower in San Francisco. Shreveport runs on precision and pace, robots humming, people tracked to the second. But in those executive towers in San Francisco, it's all glass and quiet. The light is soft, the textures are rich. You can feel status in the air itself.
Absolutely true. Architecture, light, air, texture, these aren't just amenities. They're languages of power. I always think about how design quietly decides who gets to feel comfortable and who ends up with the headache from the glare. Open spaces suggest creativity for some and confinement for others. You see it everywhere, even in the algorithms meant to create fairness. They often just reproduce the same inequalities in new forms.
And that contrast isn't just dramatic, it's revealing. Take Salesforce, for example. The company talks about access and inclusion, but you still see zoning, where certain roles get the best views, the daylight, the quiet corners. In theory, technology should flatten hierarchies, but in practice, it often just rebrands them. Sometimes it even makes the inequity harder to ignore. You can see it in how badge data and access privileges are managed in hybrid offices. It's hierarchy written into software.
That's the Elysium metaphor, isn't it? Space divided so precisely that you know your place the moment you walk in. If design can teach hierarchy, it can also teach empathy. Imagine offices with shared daylight, adjustable lighting, and acoustics anyone can control, paired with open data about how those spaces are used. The aspiration is there, but the reality, most of the time, is still a long way off.
Exactly. The real question for the next decade is this: if architecture encodes power, how do we begin to rewrite it for equity instead of entrenchment?
I remember the early 2020s, what people called the perk wars: lounges, kombucha taps, nap pods. It was management's way of saying, we care. But really, it was about emotional management. Create a space that feels like comfort, and people are more likely to stay and absorb the culture. The trouble is, comfort can also be a kind of soft control.
Exactly. You see it in those wellness apps that turn self-care into a kind of game. They nudge you toward the right behaviors, but mostly serve company goals. And then there are spaces like Meta's Menlo Park campus, or that big renovation at One Tower Center in New Jersey. Comfort and wellness become strategies to get people back on site. It's a politics of attendance, not genuine care.
It's the HER scenario, isn't it? Technology that simulates care, tracks your mood, maybe even rewards you for being grateful. But does that really create belonging, or just a performance of it? At some point, we're not feeling better, we're performing happiness for the metrics. For whatever management decides counts as well-being.
So many employees find themselves performing gratitude just to fit in, especially in workplaces built around amenities. It's exhausting. In some of my fieldwork, I've seen how it creates even more pressure to prove you belong, not less. When comfort becomes a management tool, it ends up rewarding the people who can adapt to it, not the ones who actually need support.
That's the danger, isn't it? Comfort is never neutral. If we really want well-being, the design has to be honest about what it's collecting. It has to provide true quiet spaces, and it has to give people clear opt-out choices. Otherwise, we're just swapping old forms of discipline for a more pleasant wrapper.
Here's the brighter side. Some spaces are starting to shift from oversight to stewardship. Take PNC Tower in Pittsburgh, where energy use is displayed on public dashboards, or Copenhagen's Blocks Hub, which turns office space into a kind of civic lab. It's participation instead of policing, and that small shift changes how people relate to their work and to each other.
And we shouldn't overlook the smaller models either. Co-op workspaces like Inspiral, or urban makerspaces where the AI handles scheduling so people can focus on the craft itself. Shared dashboards, visible data, open governance. It's a real move from machine obedience to machine collaboration. That's a big leap from what we were discussing back in those consulting crisis episodes. Here, the act of caring for the space becomes part of the work itself.
Exactly. Participation only really matters when people can shape the systems that measure them. Some of the most interesting experiments I've seen involve what they call data charters, actually spelling out who owns which numbers and rotating facilitation so the same voices don't always take over. It's small, but it changes the tone of the whole space.
And that creates a kind of belonging that isn't built on compliance, but on contribution. The architecture itself supports agency, modular layouts, daylight for everyone, even a say in the furniture you use. It feels less like a machine and more like a platform for learning how to work together.
Absolutely, these examples might seem small or niche, but they point to something much bigger, a shift towards spaces where the lesson is stewardship, not surveillance.
But then comes the next dilemma, the fragmented future. Picture a multinational where one floor is red for surveillance compliance, another blue for privacy, and another green for sustainability. All right, maybe that's a bit literal, but you get the idea. The modern office is turning into a patchwork of laws and policies just as much as cultures.
You can already see this happening at places like Microsoft's hubs in Berlin, Seattle, and Singapore. Each one aligns to different data or sustainability standards. Employees end up developing what you might call spatial literacy, learning to code switch not just between languages or programs, but between legal and digital norms. It can build resilience, but just as often, it adds another layer of anxiety.
It's a bit ex machina, isn't it? One building, but multiple systems of control, all operating at once. The deeper idea here is that design starts to signal the rules and workers end up translating the norms. Meaning becomes less about belonging and more about navigation. When every interface or access point carries a different legal weight, being an employee also means being a kind of translator or a navigator through systems.
So the key is to standardize for safety and fairness, but to localize for culture. Ethical design should always default to the highest level of protection, not the lowest common denominator. And maybe that's the only way the next decade's office can stay both trusted and adaptive.
So let's come back to the big question. If machines are handling most of the measurable tasks, what does work actually mean? The office, in its 20th century form, is starting to feel like a leftover, a physical shell for digital behavior. We keep holding on to rituals of visibility and presence, but are they still relevant now?
Right. There's this big push to make the office matter again through new KPIs or hybrid rituals, but maybe that's the wrong question. Maybe what we need instead is a network of studios, civic labs, and public work commons. Not just redesigning the box, but building civic infrastructure that actually holds meaning for more diverse, distributed communities of practice. Things like flexible zoning, investment in regional studios, or policies that treat public space as part of our organizational fabric.
I like that. If layout is policy and furniture is governance, then every design choice becomes a way of teaching what we value. The more the office turns into a living framework, a kind of medium for cultural learning, the better our chances of building empathy, equity, and purpose. It's really about creating infrastructure for meaning, not just enforcing more metrics.
The real revolution isn't technological, it's cultural. If we start to see offices as places that can teach a new kind of literacy, one rooted in empathy and equity, then maybe automation can finally do what it should. Support, not replace, what makes work human.
Nicely put, Angela. There's a lot to watch in the next few years, so let's keep digging into these intersections as we go. That's all for today on Analyzing Trends.
Thanks, Simon. Always a pleasure. And thanks to everyone listening. Don't forget to join us next time as we unpick more about AI, ethics, and the spatial politics of trust. Bye for now.
Goodbye, everyone.